Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Ian McFarlane makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. It'll be his third occasion here, and this time on the publication of his book, 10 Remarkable Australians, They Made Their Mark on the World But Were Forgotten, with a foreword by Geoffrey Blaney, which has just been released, and we're calling this the launch, because this is the first public occasion on which the book has been available for sale, which it is tonight. Now, of course, Ian McFarlane's best known as the former governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, a position he held between 1996 and 2006. This is his second book. He did the 2006 Boyer Lectures called The Search for Stability, which was a very fine explanation of Australia's economy and quite an important publication. Anyway, he's here on the occasion this time of 10 Remarkable Australians, and the topic for the talk is a remarkable 10. They left their mark on Australia and then they were forgotten, but not tonight. Ian McFarlane, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard. Thank you all for coming in this appalling night. I fully expected to arrive here and just see a whole lot of name tags sitting out there and an empty auditorium. So I'm really thrilled that you all came. And I also obviously want to thank the Sydney Institute and Gerard personally, who has helped me with both this book and my previous book. I suspect the question that some of you are asking is, why did I choose to write a book on the subject, apparently outside my area of expertise? Now, it would have been much easier for me to have written a book on an economic theme. In fact, I was approached to do so by a publisher immediately after I left the Reserve Bank 13 years ago. But the subject of this book is, I don't think, totally outside my area of expertise. As a lifelong reader of history and biography, it's not a great surprise that at some point I would choose to write on the subject rather than simply read about it. In fact, I can date exactly when I first thought of the idea for this book. It was in 2003 when I was reading a biography of Rupert Brooke by an English author, and I came across an Australian called Frederick Kelly. Kelly had won the Diamond Sculls at the Henley Regatta three times and an Olympic gold medal in rowing, and so was a celebrated sportsman. But that was only the second string to his bow. His main interest was as a concert pianist and a classical music composer. And what an amazing man, I thought. I should learn more about him, possibly even write about him. Sometime later, when reading a book by a Canadian author about early attempts to climb Mount Everest, I came across the Australian George Finch, who had a good claim to being the world's most accomplished mountaineer. In 1922, he climbed higher than anyone had ever climbed before, and with better support from the British climbing establishment, may have been able to reach the top of Everest. Maybe, maybe not. But he got closer than anyone else had been able to do so until that date. And by the way, he was also a professor of chemistry and a fellow of the Royal Society. And the connection between him and Peter Finch, the first Australian to win an Academy Award for acting, was a most intriguing one. Again, I wanted to learn more, and I thought my interest would be shared by others. The third event that spurred my interest was when I came across a biography of Harry Hawker in a Berkelow catalogue. The Hawker Aircraft Company was the best-known name in British military aviation in the 20th century. People have heard of the Hawker Hurricane, which was the workhorse of the Royal Air Force in the Second World War, and the Hawker Harrier jump jet. And this company got its name from a young Australian of humble birth and limited education. Not only was Harry Hawker a trophy-winning pilot and aeroplane designer, he was the first person to attempt to fly across the Atlantic Ocean, the longest continuous flight ever attempted over water. And he only got halfway. But he survived and became a hero. That adventure in itself was worth a book. So by now the idea of a book in the form of a series of biographical essays had clearly formed. Now, I want to make it clear that my motive for writing this book was not an altruistic one. I didn't write it to rescue these people from obscurity and so create a memorial to their memory. Now, if that happens, it'll be well and good, but it would only be a byproduct of what I aim to do. My motive was a much simpler and less noble one than that. I wrote this book because I found the stories of these people very interesting, and I believe that lots of other people would find them equally interesting. In fact, the original title of the book was Interesting Lives, but I was persuaded to change it to something a bit more positive. So I ended up with 10 people, which was more than I expected when I first started writing, but they all had several things in common. They were all born in the second half of the 19th century in colonial Australia before Federation. They all spent most of their lives abroad and were, in a sense, the first wave of Australian expatriates. They all lived extremely interesting and, in many cases, adventurous lives. They all excelled at more than one thing. In fact, in some cases, three or four different things. They all became well-known, even famous, but are now largely forgotten by the public. I've put the list of 10 names before my friends on a number of occasions, and they have trouble recognising more than one or two. So readers should not feel at all inadequate if they haven't heard of most of these people. I was not interested in celebrating the already famous. So Amelba, Monash, Mawson or Kingsford Smith would not make my list. They've already been honoured with knighthoods and their portraits on banknotes. 13 people born in Australia have been commemorated on banknotes, but none are in my book. This gives me comfort that I'm not simply duplicating what is already well known. Now, my decision to write about people who are not well known did not help me when it came to finding a publisher. I was rejected by 3 large publishers who told me that the book was not commercially viable. Those were the words they used. Fortunately, I found a small publisher, Connor Court, who had confidence in me and to whom I am grateful. I can understand the attitude of the big publishers in a way. They're business people, have to make a profit in publishing in an industry where there is not much money to be made. They felt that readers would be reluctant to buy books about people they'd never heard of. Maybe they're right, but I hope not. Unfortunately, this attitude means that publishers are happy to churn out repeated biographies of the same old names, just as Hollywood studios are regularly doing remakes of old films. There have been 3 biographies of Monash published in the last decade. None, by the way, as good as the one by Geoffrey Searle in 1982. And how many biographies have there been of Ned Kelly? Well, I can tell you, there have been 12 published since 2000. And Don Bradman? 11 since 2000. And by the way, in my view, the best biography of Bradman, and I've read quite a few of them, was written by Irving Rosenwater in 1978 in England. I've already introduced you to 3 of my subjects, Kelly, Finch and Hawker. I will now go quickly through the other 7, although it's a challenge to do it quickly because they all led such eventful lives. First, George Morrison, also known as Chinese Morrison or Morrison of Peking. Traveller, doctor, journalist and personal advisor to the President of China. While he spent the second half of his life in China, and that's what he's famous for, his early adventures in Australia and the Pacific are worthy of a book in themselves. For example, at the age of 20, he walked from the Gulf of Carpentaria to Melbourne. This was only 20 years after Burke and Wills had failed to do the journey in the opposite direction. Morrison led an adventurous life in which he managed to get himself speared on one occasion in New Guinea and then shot on another occasion in China. Next, off the rank, Sir Hubert Wilkins, polar explorer and First World War photographer. As Captain Wilkins' military cross and bar, he was the only wartime photographer ever to be decorated for bravery. And he was also knighted for being the first person to fly from America to Europe across the Arctic Ocean. He also had the Order of Lenin pinned on him by Stalin, not for services to communism, but for his Arctic exploits when he was searching for lost Russian airmen. He was also the first person to attempt to go under the North Pole by submarine. He failed, and many people thought he was mad to try it. Yet 27 years later, two US submarines went under the North Pole. Next, Henry Handel Richardson. Under this pen name, she wrote what many considered to be the great Australian novel, The Fortunes of Richard Marnie. It is in fact a trilogy of three separate novels that took her 20 years to write. She is better known for a lighter piece, The Getting of Wisdom, which was made into a popular film in the 1970s. Both were written in London, but she spent 15 years before that in Germany, mainly training to be a pianist. Next, Lyndhurst Faulkner Giblin, scholar, marginal member of the Bloomsbury Group, international sportsman, gold prospector, plantation manager, member of parliament, who volunteered for the First World War at the age of 43 and came back as Major Giblin, Military Cross and Distinguished Service Order. At the age of 47, he turned to economics and ended up as a professor of economics at Melbourne University and the most important economic advisor to the Australian government during the Depression and the Second World War. Next, John Peter Russell, trained as an engineer, but turned to painting, spent most of his life in France, first in Paris and later in Brittany. One of the few people to form an easy friendship with Vincent van Gogh. He also knew Monet, Rodin and Matisse. He was a wealthy man, lived a very comfortable life and raised a large family in France. He died in obscurity. Now his best paintings are worth more than $1 million. Next, Gilbert Murray, scholar, playwright, poet, and authority on ancient Greek. Made a professor at the age of 23, then spent a decade in the London theatre world. George Bernard Shaw parodied him in his play Major Barbara. Murray returned to academia and was appointed Regius Professor of Greek at Oxford University. He became a very prominent public intellectual in Britain and the author of 61 books. I don't know how he writes 61 books, but he did. Married into the British aristocracy, then spent much of the rest of his life campaigning for peace via the League of Nations. Finally, Reginald Snowy Baker, reputed to be Australia's greatest all-round sportsman, who represented Australia internationally at four different sports, claimed to have excelled in 26 different sports, later became a boxing promoter, whose life was intertwined with the tragedy of Les Darcy, became a pioneer of the Australian film industry, making 5 films in Australia and 6 in Hollywood, where he lived from his mid-30s. Each essay in this book tells a story of how a life developed from birth, childhood, education, marriage, family relationships, professional achievements and setbacks. I try to make an assessment of their character and how important they were in the wider scheme of things. So the book is mainly about people, but it's also about historical events in which they participated, about different countries, and about the times in which they lived. The stories tell us a lot about Australia at that time, even though most of the action takes place overseas. The thing I wanted to emphasise about Australia was that even in this early time, we were very outward-looking. Physically, we were insular, but mentally, we were always looking abroad for inspiration. And this is not surprising. If you are small, you have to look abroad. A citizen of London, New York or Paris might think that everything worthwhile was available at home. If you're from a small country, you would never make this mistake. Each of my subjects started their odyssey by getting on a ship and sailing to London. That was always the starting point. But their stories broadened out from there so that France, Germany, Switzerland, the United States, Canada and China also figure prominently in these stories. But the link with Britain was still extremely strong, and the similarities and differences between the two countries are a constant background. The English statesman Sir Charles Duke visited Australia in 1880 and was surprised by the similarities between the two countries. He said, "Australia was like England with the upper class left out." And I think there's a lot to be said for that summary. We had mostly English institutions, English law and English education, and we had rich and poor citizens like England. But we didn't have a leisure class with private incomes who didn't have to work. Nor did we have the equivalent of Eton, although we inherited the English system of private schools. We had six universities at this time of roughly equal status. We didn't have an Oxford or a Cambridge. In our armed forces, we didn't have smart regiments and not so smart ones. The English liked to establish a hierarchy within each area of life. We didn't. We really didn't have a class system to speak of. So we were clearly more egalitarian than the mother country, and we were richer in terms of national income per head. But we were a lot smaller. Only 3.8 million people in 1900 compared to 40 million for Britain. We're now up to 25 million and are closing the gap with Britain, which has 60 million. In other words, we were less than 10% and now we're moving up close to 50%. As a result of the great post-war immigration program, we're also more multicultural and less British than we used to be. However, a lot of the British influence lingers and has underpinned the stability of our democracy. Some people are surprised when I remind them that five of our post-war prime ministers went to Oxford. And there would have been six if Kim Beazley had won one of the elections he contested. See if you can work out who the five were. Although the book concentrates on 10 remarkable Australian lives, lots of other familiar names are dotted through the pages. From Australia, Prime Ministers Barton, Fisher, Hughes, Bruce, Scullin and Lyons make appearances, as do Monash and Melbourne, and sportsmen such as Trumper, Spofforth and Darcy, as well as painters Roberts and Streeton. When we move abroad, no account of this historical epic will be complete without a role for Churchill, who appears in two essays, as does Einstein. Figures from the world of entertainment also appear, such as George Bernard Shaw and Charlie Chaplin. One that surprised me was that the actress Elizabeth Taylor gets three mentions. How could this possibly be? Well, it turns out that Snowy Baker taught her how to ride a horse when she was a teenager for the film National Velvet that made her famous. She also co-starred with Peter Finch in a film, so she gets a mention in the Finch essay. MGM made another film starring her called Rhapsody, based on a book by Henry Handel Richardson, so she gets a mention in the Richardson essay. I'm indebted for this last piece of information to Bruce Beresford, who was the director of the Getting Wisdom. He then went on to describe Rhapsody as an absolute stinker. One thing I was certain of when I planned this book is that I wanted it to be a series of essays or chapters. I was never interested in writing a whole book about one life. I've always liked the concept of a book of essays. My favourites when I was younger were by Bertrand Russell and George Orwell. More recent masters of the essay form are Clive James, Malcolm Gladwell. And specifically biographical essays also have a long pedigree, starting with Aubrey's Brief Lives in the 17th century. Australian examples are John Hetherington's Australians, Nine Profiles, and more recently, someone who's spoken here, Ross McMullen's Farewell, Dear People. I find it satisfying to read a series of short biographical essays because each is different. As John Howard expressed it, each of these people is refreshingly different. If the one you're reading is not exactly to your taste, the next one probably will be. There's always something to look forward to. Now, I should add at this point that, to the best of my knowledge, none of the subjects of these biographies ever met another. There are two cases where one refers to another, but no cases of actual meetings. The other thing I had strong views on was the structure of the printed book. Not only do I like reading books, I like books as physical objects. I like them to be well designed, well printed, and well bound. That's why this book is an illustrated hardback with stitched binding. It is more expensive than a paperback or a hardback with glued binding, but it is a better and longer-lasting book. So that, ladies and gentlemen, brings me to the end of my presentation. I hope that you get as much pleasure out of reading the book as I did out of the research and writing. The only part for me that was exasperating, as you've no doubt gathered, was finding a publisher, but I finally found one, and I am completely happy with what he produced. But before I found him, I consoled myself with the fact that J.K. Rowling was rejected by 12 publishers before she found one that would take a chance on her Harry Potter series, which allowed her to become the biggest selling author of the past 100 years. Thank you very much.
So many thanks to Ian McFarlane. As I said, we've got copies of 10 Remarkable Australians for sale tonight, and they're down the end there, and it is a remarkably fine production, as I was saying earlier. Very well bound, it's great leading, plenty of gaps and in between the lines, easy to read, and a fine publication. So well done. So before we go on to the general question, tell us a bit about yourself, because as I recall from memory, I think it's right, you're a graduate of Monash University, you studied economics there. I suspect that Monash Publishing wouldn't publish a book, in spite of the fact that you're one of their most famous graduates. Would that be correct?
Well, I actually approached them, not personally, but I went to their website, and to put in an application and to fight my way through the bureaucracy and fill in all the forms. It was going to take me a couple of days just to put in an application, so I didn't go ahead with it.
There's the modern university, yeah. Now, so then you become the governor of the Reserve Bank, and most economists are well-meaning types, are pretty dull, but you must have spent a lot of time reading history. So how did those two jobs go together? I mean, did you have a book under the desk?
No. I read at night, of course. But it's an interesting observation. I was saying to Rory before, the longer I was in the job and the more I got interested in history and economic history, and the less I got interested in last month's retail trade figures or the next month's balance of payments, I started to find that the things that were really interesting were the things that happened over longer periods and happened very slowly and were much more profound than the quarterly or monthly economic statistics that I looked at.
Fancy that. No, you said come back here. Okay, so Jacqueline.
I wanted to ask you, sort of a an economic question, but I have to get, I can't get past, where did you find all of these people? You talk about reading a couple of essays here and there, but to find 10 of them, but one's only a woman, I just sort of, on the side.
Well, I'll talk about that too. Five of them I found by accident. I listed those first three. I found them by accident. I found them in books that had nothing to do with Australia. And this really interesting Australian just popped up. So that's what got me the idea of writing the book. I have to admit, some of the others I did know a little bit about. I knew a bit about Morrison. I knew a bit about Baker. And so I added that, but didn't know much. But I knew they were from the same era and they had the same experience of going overseas and becoming famous. So that's how I ended up. But originally it was the five that I found by accident. Now the issue of why is there only one woman in the book? And the answer is, it was very, very hard to get one woman in the book. I couldn't put Melba in because she was too famous. She was the most famous Australian ever. Geoffrey Blainey says that without doubt she was the most famous Australian ever. If you had to ask anyone in the first half of the 20th century, name an Australian, they'd instantly be able to say Melba. Then you say, name a second one, and they wouldn't be able to. It's a bit like if I said to you, quickly, name a Belgian. Or even, I think, sometimes, name a Canadian. It's very hard to do that. But she was so famous that everyone just knew she was Australian. And after that, I looked for who else could I put, find a woman from that era who fitted those criteria. And I thought Dame Mary Gilmore might be an opportunity. First of all, obviously, you look for literature, because that's where women excelled earlier in that era. And I thought Dame Mary Gilmore might be an opportunity, but I ruled her out because she's already got... she's a dame and she's on a banknote and all that stuff. And then I found Henry Handel Richardson. But it was I asked various people for their advice too, and... and that's what it narrowed down to.
Okay, there's a question here.
Yes, thanks for your talk tonight and, of course, your publication. Eccentricity, I think, seems to be a beautiful theme in your book and of the subjects you've talked about. Could you enlarge on that? And is Australia producing its due quota of eccentrics or not?
Well, we probably aren't. I mean, I'm trying to think who are those I would call an eccentric. The only one I can think of, they're all unusual, and they're all very individualistic. They all live life the way they wanted to do. They weren't conformists. That's certainly the case. The only one I could think of who was actually an eccentric was Giblin, the economist, who had very strange ways of dressing. He didn't believe in ties. He just tie a bit of material around his neck. He didn't believe in polishing his shoes. He dubbined his shoes. I had to get the dictionary to find out what dubbined meant. It's running, rubbing animal fat in your shoes. He cut the lapels off his suits. He thought that was an affectation. He was the only one who was really eccentric. All the others were definitely individual, but he was the only one who was both individual and eccentric.
Was that his dark secret?
Hang on, just a second. Okay, we don't do okay, but so was it his dark secret? But I think we'll come back to that, Rory, because you got the question after next. We're going up here.
I wanted to ask about Giblin, because I just looked through the chapter, and I'm fascinated that you exposed his dark secret, his pederasty. I did a bit on Giblin because I was doing the history of lions, biography of lions, and I think it was his handwriting in the National Library, the letters, it was almost impossible to read, but they did make me wonder about his relationship with his wife, whom he almost never seemed to be with. Could you give us a bit of background about all this? Because it's also connected with the ABC. Jared's had his little thing about the ABC and their show, their program on pederasty. In my sense, this is the big story of the book.
Yeah, I didn't mention that in my summary. He's a very strange character, Giblin. He was really three different people. There was this great, big, strong outdoor man, you know, the soldier. Would you believe this? He was a Tasmanian, and he played three rugby tests for England. Definitely did. I looked up the record. And he was a gold prospector. He did all these really tough, manly things. He also had the intellectual side. He was very interested in literature, and then, of course, he became a professor. But the strange aspect of him was he was always interested in boys, and particularly boys' literature. He had a huge library of sort of schoolboy books, some of which he accumulated even when he was in his mid-50s. There were two books that, they're not biographies of him, but refer to him, and they drop all these hints about his interest in boys. And I decided, well, I might as well, you know, instead of dropping hints, I'll say the third aspect of him is one which today you would call pederasty, I think. Although I don't know, and I'm prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt as to whether it ever took physical form. But he certainly was obsessed with little boys and boys' literature right through to when he died in his 70s.
So just to clarify, the reference to the ABC was his association with Professor Richard Downing, who was chairman of the ABC in 1975 and defended a program on pederasty, which is where that comes in. So Downing was, what, a young man at the time he knew Giblin?
They'd be 20 years apart, I think. Yeah. Maybe 25 years apart. Yeah, they're different generations.
Downing's born 1915. When's Giblin born?
Oh, 1888 or something like that.
Yeah, that right. Yeah. Okay, Rory.
I didn't actually realise that was the secret.
You thought the secret was cutting off his lapels.
No, I thank you very much for signing the book I bought earlier. I recommend everyone get one. As an economist, I went straight to the chapter on the economist, and there was the mention of something that other people hadn't confronted. But so that's been asked. So my question is, so all these people doing all these extraordinary things, sometimes three and four each, is this a sort of an illustration that most people are bumbling through life and, you know, opportunities emerge and, you know, competent people can grab them? What do you think the sort of the lesson from this is, say, if you've got a 12 or 14-year-old son, or anyone, sort of daughters, sons, cousins, what do you think is sort of the learnings for life in this?
I don't know whether there are. I do think that in that era, I mean, most of this is set between about 1880 and 1920. In that era, life was much less specialised and much less competitive. So it was possible to excel at more than one thing, and it was possible to take up something late in life and excel at it. I don't think there's any way anyone could do that today. I think...
not even me.
I was going to say, definitely not you, Rory. I just think it was very... I mean, some of this stuff, some of the things that at that time that looked upon as great achievements actually weren't. I mean, Snowy Baker became a hero because he had won a silver medal at the 1908 Olympic Games in boxing. You go back and look at the records, there are only four countries competed. And it was held in England, and Britain fielded 32 boxers, France 7, Denmark 2, and Australia 1. And so of the five divisions and the three medals awarded in each, Britain won 14 of the 15. So, and Snowy Baker only ever fought British boxers. So, in fact, what he did was equivalent to being second in the British Amateur Boxing Championship. But it sounds a lot better to say, I won a silver medal in the Olympic Games. So... and he, this business about how he represented Australia in four sports, and three sports at one Olympics, that's true. But in those early days, the Olympics were a joke, really. None of the big sporting associations had the money to send the best athlete over. So the athletes who went over were those who were rich enough or those who were already over there. In the first Olympic Games in Athens, Australia won. What's his name?
Flack, was it?
Pardon?
Flack or
Flack? Yeah, Flack. Edward Flack. Flack. He won the 800 and the 1500 metres. He only entered because he happened to be in London at the time, so no one came from Australia, so he represented us. And in the 800 metres final, he had played the doubles tennis in the morning, and then he won the 800 metres final in the afternoon. So, it was possible to do a lot of things. I mean, it was really, in some sense, the era of the enlightened amateur, whereas now we are very definitely in the era of the professional, the specialised professional.
Thank you very much, Mr. McFarlane. My question relates to the first person you've spoken about, Mr. Kelly, as a music composer. How does he compare with, say, Percy Grainger? Because there's not too much written about him either.
Well, Grainger went to the same, studied at the same institute in Frankfurt as Kelly, but Grainger was older. But Kelly knew Grainger, and one of Kelly's best compositions was in honour of Grainger. But Grainger, talking about eccentrics, but Grainger was very different to Kelly. Grainger was poor and, he's, as I say, extremely eccentric. He lived a lot longer. He became quite egotistical in the end. He established a museum to himself in Melbourne. But they definitely knew each other. And of course, because Grainger lived so much longer, he created a much bigger body of work. The one that people compare Kelly to is Vaughan Williams. They were very parallel in time and the quality of their work, but of course Kelly's life was cut short.
There's a question down there.
Did you ever think about Dorothea McKellar?
I'm glad that people brought up another name. I'm assuming when I do these presentations there will be people from the audience who will say, what about so-and-so? Why didn't you put them in? Because there might be room for another book, but not by me. Dorothea McKellar gets a mention because Kelly met her and thought highly of her. But I don't think that her achievement, her literary achievements, are anywhere near as great as the literary achievements of Henry Handel Richardson. So that's why Richardson got ahead of, apart from the fact that Dorothea McKellar wrote a poem that we've all heard of, and none of us have probably read The Fortunes of Richard Marty. Has anyone read? One? Two? In the 50s, that was definitely regarded as the great Australian novel. It was like, she had a position in the 1950s, after her death, that Patrick White had in the 60s. If you wanted to be an educated person, you had to buy books by Patrick White. How many people actually got to the end of them, I don't know. And Henry Handel Richardson was a bit like that. Getting through The Fortunes of Richard Armani is a big challenge. It was a big challenge for me. It took me about a month.
Thank you very much, Governor, and I'm looking forward to reading our books. You mentioned something very interesting because you say the current generation, the people are a lot less adventurous. Do you think that it's got to do with the economic lifestyle of the modern people, because we tend to borrow so much money, and so you really have to stick with one job and pay off your loan with the, and also with the negative interest rate, basically you cannot retire on your income from your savings. You have to spend your savings.
I thought I'd got away from interest rates 13 years ago. I don't think people are necessarily less adventurous. I mean, these weren't the average people. These were very unusual people. I mean, the big difference that I think between then and now, as I said, is you could be good at a number of things. You didn't have to be specialised. But I suppose in this era, most people weren't adventurous. And therefore, I didn't write books about people who weren't adventurous. I wrote a book about people who were adventurous.
So there's a question here. Let's get the microphone to you.
I applaud your effort. Are there any reforms that you would like to see to the Order of Australia?
I don't know that that's exactly on the topic.
No, I don't. I don't have a view either way under the Order of Australia.
No one in here got a gong, did they, from under the Order of Australia, because that was introduced in 1975.
The last of these people died in 1970, and it was in England. That was Finch, the mountaineer.
Can you tell us a little bit more then about the research? If these people were little known, did you find all your information here, or did you have to travel abroad?
A good question. No, I didn't travel abroad. The first thing you do is you read biographies. Most of these people were prominent enough to have biographies written of them. But then with a biography, you've got to be a little bit suspicious, because biographers tend to get to like their subject, and sometimes they fall in love with their subject. And so biographers tend to possibly overstate the importance of their subject, and they're not as sceptical as they might. So you've got to read a lot of other stuff that concern these people that are not actually their biography. You've got to read other books where other people give their opinions on them. I ended up... in the bibliography, I list 90 books. And the interesting thing is, I own 74 of them, because that was the most efficient way of getting these books, most of which were out of print, and they're not available in libraries. But there's a wonderful site called biblio.com, I don't know if anyone uses this, which amalgamates all the catalogues of sort of virtually all the thousands of second-hand and antiquarian booksellers around the world. And you just plug in the book you want, and it sort of tells you which places have got these. Within one click, you can buy the book. And most of them are modestly priced, you know, $15, $20, $25. Some of them are even less. They're less than the postage. A couple of them are a couple of $100. But so it was really just wide reading, and it was reading sort of what I would call sideways, which was a very large part of the research. I had other things that helped me. I had at least five people I knew who were actually experts or enthusiasts on particular people. They're in, and a number of another exactly five different five. I was able to read diaries and letters. And the other thing that a modern writer has got a huge advantage with is a thing called the internet. You're doing some research. Come across a name that's incidental to the story, important for the story, but you haven't heard of. You've got the Australian National Dictionary of Biography. One click and you've got a biography, and you've got Wikipedia. And you know, so an event comes up, or a place name, or a person who you ought to know about, and you can instantly find an answer. And the other thing I refer to is sporting records. They've all been, you know, put on the internet. So I was able to check up on two people were claimed to have been British boxing champions. Two of the writers on Russell claimed he was, and Gilbert Murray claimed his brother was. So you could look it all up there. It goes back to about 1850. You know, every division, every year. It takes you 5 minutes. I don't know how you would have done that in earlier years. It would have been extremely difficult. And I already mentioned the stuff on Olympic Games. Not only do they tell you who won each medal, they tell you how many people entered, from which country. I mean, everything's there at your fingertips. So that makes life easier.
So don't keep us in suspense. Was any of them the British boxing champion?
No. Well, sorry, Snowy Baker.
No, of those ones.
No. Russell wasn't. He did box. Amazing how many people boxed in those days. He did box, but he didn't win it. Hubert Murray, who was the brother of Gilbert Murray, did enter it, but he didn't win it. Some of the biggest howlers, so the worst person for making errors, was the great scholar Gilbert Murray, because he wrote an autobiography at the age of 80, in which he claimed to remember all sorts of things that happened in his school days and what have you. Obviously, his editors in England didn't know much about Australia, because the book includes howlers like he has. Canberra is on the Murray, Yass is in the Blue Mountains. He says his father met the leader of Fiji on his visit to Australia, and it turns out that the leader of Fiji visited Australia for the first time 7 years after Murray's father had died. He claimed his brother won the British Boxing Championship. He didn't. That's one of the things when I look back on, is how much of what is written turns out to be wrong. I didn't discover many new things. I discovered a few new things. But I certainly discovered an awful lot of things that are meant to be true that turned out to be totally untrue. And the fact is, there's enough amazing things that happen that are correct that you don't need to make up new ones.
Question here.
For the record, I thought I should state that as a Tasmanian, almost my earliest girlfriend was a great-granddaughter of Giblin.
Ah.
And I can certainly endorse the fact that eccentricity is a family tradition.
She chose you.
No, he said it was a former girlfriend.
That isn't what I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask whether there are any themes running through all these characters that I could perhaps use in educating and guiding my grandmother sons.
I don't think so. I really think, I mean, we think it's difficult. I mean, I think it's difficult. I've got grandchildren too. And I just don't really feel that everything's changed so quickly in recent decades that I don't think my advice would be of any value. And it certainly wouldn't be of any value if I went back and looked at these people 100 years ago and tried to extrapolate from their experiences. I think we've all got to accept, looking around our age group, that that we really can't do it. I don't know how to give advice to my 12-year-old grandson, for example. I've got no idea what sort of career he should go into. I've got I find it quite perplexing, and I'm sure all of us do.
So we're getting close to the end.
I just want to point out, Lyndhurst Giblin didn't have any children.
He didn't. No, hang on.
So she's obviously made something up.
He had brothers and sisters, so she was related to him, but she wouldn't have been a direct descendant. You're right, he didn't have children. He had this strange marriage that you refer to. There's a whole biography of his wife, and there's no biography of him. No doubt your former girlfriend was from the Giblin family, but she would not have been a direct descendant.
I just say there's a lot of those myths in Tasmania.
All I can say is that Tasmania's got a smaller market for books than other states, so you'll be okay. Don't worry about that. So I think we've virtually come to the end. So let me... I haven't missed anyone. So just in conclusion, I mean, you've been beavering away at this for a long time. You got any other books planned? And what about your own? I mean, do you have recollections of events that never happened that would make you write? That would qualify you to write a memoir?
Yeah, I'll wait till I'm in my mid-80s, and then I can write anything. Well, the worst example is Wilkins, the great explorer. There were four biographies of Wilkins that were published from about 1960 onwards, and they give a description of some of the things he did in his early years, which to me were just ridiculous. I just read it and I said, this cannot possibly be true. And I actually covered sheets of paper with this fellow said he did that. It was an amazing story, how he stowed on aboard on a ship and he went to North Africa and met an Italian spy who was running guns, and they were captured by Arabs, taken to an oasis, rescued by a beautiful Arab maiden. And I thought, this is just ridiculous. But the people who wrote the biographies, well, one of them expressed reservations, the others just recorded it as fact. And finally, I read another writer, a Melbourne writer called Jeff Maynard, who's a very good writer, who's done some very good stuff on Wilkins. And he's gone over to America and he's gone through all the papers and everything. And he just, in his book, just said, don't pay any attention to these. They're entirely fictitious. They were. So that's four books in a row. And it includes stuff that is not only, in my view, not only wrong, but ridiculous. That's the extreme example of published material being wrong. That's more extreme than the other examples I gave.
Many thanks, Ian McFarlane. So as I said, we've got copies of 10 Remarkable Australians published by Anthony Capello at Connor Court in Queensland. Now, as to our speaker, thanks for an empirical, with a lot of warning about memory, an empirical account of 10 important Australians who were pretty well soon forgotten, but also for telling the individual 10 stories with facts and a sense of humour, which was great. So well done tonight. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.